In conjunction with the International Yoga Day of June 21st, 2018, today we read The Conditions of the Synthesis of Yoga by Sri Aurobindo. One, life and yoga. There are two necessities of nature's workings which seem always to intervene in the greater forms of human activity. Whether these belong to our ordinary fields of movement or seek those exceptional spheres and fulfillments which appear to us high and divine, every such form tends towards a harmonized complexity and totality, which again breaks apart into various channels of special effect and tendency, only to unite once more in a larger and more poignant synthesis. Secondly, development into forms is an imperative rule of effective manifestation, yet all truth and practice too strictly formulated becomes old and loses much, if not all, of its virtue. It must be constantly renovated by fresh streams of the spirit, reviving the dead or dying vehicle and changing it, if it is to acquire a new life. We are in an age full of throes of travail, when all forms of thought and activity that have in themselves any strong power of utility or any secret virtue of persistence are being subjected to a supreme test and given their opportunity of rebirth. The world today presents the aspects of huge conundrum of Medea, in which all things are being cast, shredded into pieces, experimented on, combined and recombined, either to perish and provide the scattered materials of new forms, or to emerge rejuvenated and changed for a fresh term of existence. Indian yoga, in its essence, a special action or formulation of certain great powers of nature, itself specialized, divided, and variously formulated, is potentially one of these dynamic elements of the future life of humanity. The child of immemorial ages, preserved by its vitality and truth into our modern times, it is now emerging from the secret schools and ascetic retreats in which it has taken refuge and is seeking its place in the future sum of living human powers and utilities. But it has first to rediscover itself, bring to the surface the profoundest reason of its being in that general truth and in that unceasing aim of nature which it represents, and find by virtue of this new self-knowledge and self-appreciation its own recovered and larger synthesis. In the right view both of life and of yoga, all life is either consciously or subconsciously a yoga. For we mean by this term a methodized effort towards self-perfection by the expression of the secret potentialities latent in the being and highest condition of victory in that effect, a union of their human individual with the universal and transcendent existence we see partially expressed in man and in their cosmos. But all life, when we look behind its appearance, is a vast yoga of nature, who attempts in their conscious and their subconscious to realize her perfection in a ever-increasing expression of her yet unrealized potentialities, and to unite herself with her own divine reality. In man, her thinker, she for the first time upon this earth devises self-conscious means and willed arrangements of activities by which this great purpose may be more swiftly and poignantly attained. Yoga, as Swami Vivekananda has said, may be regarded as a means of compressing one's evolution into a single life or a few years or even a few months of bodily existence. A given system of yoga then can be no more than a selection or a compression into a narrower but more energetic forms of intensity of the general method, which are already being used loosely, largely in a leisurely movement with a profuse apparent waste of material and energy, but with a more complete combination by the Great Mother in her vast upward labor. It is this view of yoga that can alone form the basis of a sound and rational synthesis of yogic methods. For then yoga ceases to appear something mystic and abnormal, which has no relation to the ordinary processes of the world energy or the purposes she keeps in view in her two great movements of subjective and objective self-fulfillment. It reveals itself rather as an intense and exceptional use of powers that she has already manifested or is progressively organizing in her less exalted but more general operations. Yogic methods have something of the same relation to the customary psychological workings of a man as has their scientific handling of the force of electricity or of stream of their normal operations in nature. And they too, like the operations of science, are formed upon a knowledge developed and confirmed by regular experiment, practical analysis, and constant result. All methods grouped under the common name of yoga are special psychological processes founded on a fixed truth of nature and developing out of normal functions, powers, and results which were always latent but which her ordinary movements do not easily or do not often manifest. But as in physical knowledge, the multiplication of scientific processes has its disadvantages, as that tends, for instance, to develop a victorious artificiality which overwhelms our natural human life under a load of machinery, and to purchase certain forms of freedom and mastery at the price of an increased servitude. So the preoccupation with yogic processes and their exceptional results may have its disadvantages and losses. The yogin tends to draw away from the common existence and lose his hold upon it. He tends to purchase wealth of spirit by an impoverishment of his human activities, the inner freedom by an outer death. If he gains God, he loses life, or if he turns his efforts outward to conquer life, he is in danger of losing God. Therefore, we see in India that a sharp incompatibility has been created between life and the world and spiritual growth and perfection. And although the tradition and ideal of victorious harmony between the inner attraction and the outer demand remains, it is little or else very imperfectly exemplified. No synthesis of yoga can be satisfying which does not, in its aim, reunite God and nature in a liberated and perfected human life, or in its method not only permit but favor the harmony of our inner and outer activities and experiences in the divine consummation of both. For man is precisely that term and symbol of a higher existence descended into the material world, in which it is possible for the lower to transfigure itself and put on the nature of the higher, and higher to reveal itself in the forms of the lower. The true and full object and utility of yoga can only be accomplished when the conscious yoga in man becomes like the subconscious yoga in nature. Outwardly conterminous with life itself, and we can once more, looking out both on the path and their achievements, say in a more perfect and luminous sense, quote, "A life is yoga," unquote. Two, the three steps of nature, the progressive self-manifestation of nature in man, termed in modern language his evolution, must necessarily depend upon three successive elements. There is that which is already evolved, there is that which, still imperfect, still partly fluid, is persistently in the stage of conscious evolution, and there is that which is to be evolved and may perhaps be already displayed. That which nature has evolved for us and has firmly founded is their bodily life. She has affected a certain combination and harmony of their inferior but most fundamentally necessary elements of our actions and progress upon earth. Matter, which, however, thereto ethereally spiritual may be despite it, is our foundation and the first condition of all our energies and realizations. And the life energy, which is our means of existence in a material body and the basis there, even of our mental and spiritual activities. This is what is meant by the fable in the Aitreya Upanishad, which tells us that the gods rejected the animal forms successively ordered to them by the divine self, and only when man was produced cried out, quote, "This indeed is the perfectly made," unquote, and consented to enter in. She has effected also a working compromise between the inertia of matter and the active life that lives in and feeds on it, by which not only is vital existence sustained, but their fullest developments of mentality are rendered possible. This equilibrium constitutes the basic status of nature in man, and is termed in the language of yoga his gross body, composed of the material of food sheath and the nervous system of vital vehicle. It can be, therefore, no integral yoga which ignores the body or makes it annulment, or it rejects indispensable to a perfect spirituality. Rather, the perfecting of the body also should be the last triumph of the spirit, and to make this bodily life also divine must be God's final seal upon his work in the universe. The obstacle which the physical presents to the spiritual is no argument for the rejection of the physical. For in the unseen providence of things, our greatest difficulties are our best opportunities. A supreme difficulty is nature's indication to us of a supreme conquest to be won and by ultimate problems to be solved. It is not a warning of an inextricable snare to be shunned or of an enemy too strong for us from whom we must flee. Equally, the vital and nervous energies in us are there for a greater utilities. They too demand the divine realization of their possibilities and our ultimate fulfillment. The great part assigned to this element in the universal scheme is powerfully emphasized by the Catholic wisdom of the Upanishads. Quote, as the spokes of a wheel in its nave, so in the life energy is all established, the triple knowledge and the sacrifice of the power of the strong and the purity of the wise. Under the control of the life energy is all this that is established in the triple heaven. Unquote. It is therefore no integral yoga that kills these vital energies, forces them into a nervousless quiescence, or root them out as their source of nauseous activities. The purification, not their destruction, the transformation, control, and utility is the aim in view with which they have been created and developed in us. If the bodily life is what nature has firmly evolved for us as her base and her first instrument, it is our mental life that she is evolving as her immediate next aim and superior instrument. For here in man, we have a distinction which is of the utmost importance. He is in him not a single mentality, not a double and a triple. The mind material and nervous, their pure intellectual mind which liberates itself from their illusions of the body and their senses, and a divine mind above intellect which in its turn liberates itself from their imperfect modes of the logically discriminative and imaginative reason. Mind in man is first enmeshed in the life of their body, where in the plant it is entirely involved, and in animals always imprisoned. It accepts this life is not only the first but the whole condition of its activities and serves its needs as if they were the entire aim of existence. But the bodily life in man is a base, not the aim, his first condition and not his last determinant. In the just idea of ancient man is essentially the thinker, the manu, the mental being who leads the life in the body, not the animal who is led by them. The mental life thus evolving in man is not indeed a common possession. In actual appearance, it would seem as if it were only developed for the fullest in individuals, and as if there were great numbers and even the majority in whom it is either a small and ill-organized part of their normal nature, or not evolved at all, or latent and not easily made active. Certainly, the mental life is not a finished evolution of nature. It is not firmly founded in the human animal. Moreover, the whole trend of modern thought and modern endeavor reveals itself to their observant eye as a large conscious effort of nature and man to effect a general level of intellectual equipment, capacity, and further possibility by universalizing the opportunities which modern civilization affords for the mental life. Even the preoccupation of the European intellect, the protagonist of this tendency, this material nature and their externalities of existence, is a necessary part of their effect. It seeks to prepare a sufficient basis in man's physical being and vital energies, and in his material environment for his full mental possibilities. By the spread of education, by the advance of the backward races, by the elevation of depressed classes, by the multiplication of labor-saving appliances, by the movement towards ideal social and economic condition, by the labor of science towards an improved health, longevity, and sound physique in civilized humanity. With sense and drift of this vast movement translates itself in easily intelligible signs. At present, the material and economic aim may be predominant, but always behind their works and their weights and reserve the higher and major impulse. And when the primary conditions are satisfied, when the great endeavor has found its base, what will be the nature of that further possibility which the activities of the intellectual life must serve? If mind is indeed nature's highest term, then the entire development of the rational and imaginative intellect and the harmonious satisfaction of the emotions and the sensibilities must be to themselves sufficient. But if, on the contrary, man is more than a reasoning and emotional animal, if beyond that which is being evolved there is something that has to be evolved, then it may well be that the fullness of the mental life, the suppleness, flexibility, and wide capacity of the intellect, the ordered richness of emotion and sensibility, may be the only a passage towards the development of a higher life and a more powerful faculties which are yet to be manifest and to take possession of the lower instrument, just as mind itself has to take possession of the body, that the physical being no longer lives only for its satisfaction, but provides the foundation and the materials of a superior activity. The assertion of a higher than mental life is the whole foundation of the Indian philosophy, and its acquisition and organization is the veritable object served by the methods of yoga. Mind is not the last term of evolution, not an ultimate aim, but like body, an instrument. It is even so termed in the language of yoga, the inner instrument. The Indian tradition asserts that this which is to be manifested is not a new term in human experience, but has been developed before and has even governed humanity in certain periods of its development. In any case, in order to be known, it must be one time have been partly developed. And if since then nature has sunk back from her achievement, the reason must always be found in some unrealized harmony, some inefficiency of the intellect, and material bases to which she has now returned some over-specialization of the higher to the detriment of the lower existence. But what then constitutes this higher or highest existence to which our evolution is tending? In order to answer the question, we have to deal with a class of supreme experiences, a class of unusual conceptions which it is difficult to represent accurately in any other language than the ancient Sanskrit tongue, in which alone they have been to some extent systematized. The ultimate knowledge is that which perceives and accepts God in the universal as well as beyond the universe. The integral yoga is that which, having found the transcendent, can return upon the universe and possess it, retaining the power freely to descend as well as ascend the greater sphere of existence. For if their eternal wisdom exists at all, the faculty of mind must also have some higher use and destiny. We perceive then these three steps in nature: a bodily life, which is the basis of our existence here in the material world, a mental life into which we emerge and by which we raise the bodily to higher uses and enlarge it into a greater completeness, and a divine existence, which is at once the goal of the other two and returns upon them to liberate them into their highest possibilities. Regarding none of them as either beyond our reach or below our name, and the destruction of none of them as essential to their ultimate attainment, we accept this liberation and fulfillment as part, at least and at large, an important part of the aim of yoga. Synthesis. By the very nature of the principal yogic schools, each covering in its operations a part of the complex human integer and attempting to bring out its highest possibilities, it will appear that a synthesis of all of them largely conceived and applied might well result in an integral yoga. But they are so disparate in their tendencies, so highly specialized and elaborated in their forms, so long confirmed in the mutual opposition of their ideals and methods, that we do not easily find how we can arrive at their right union. The synthesis we propose cannot then be arrived at either by combination in mass or by successive practice. It must therefore be effected by neglecting the forms and outsides of the yogic disciplines and seizing rather on some central principle common to all, which will include and utilize in the right place and proportion their particular principles, and on some central dynamic force which is their common secret of the divergent methods, and capable therefore of organizing a natural selection and combination of their varied energies and different utilities. This was the aim which we set before ourselves. At first, when we enter upon our comparative examination of the methods of nature and the methods of yoga, and we now return to it with the possibility of hazarding some definite solution. We see then what, from the psychological point of view, and yoga is nothing but practical psychology, is the conception of nature from which we have to start. The lower nature, that which we know and are and must remain so long as the faith in us is not changed, acts through limitation and division, is of the nature of ignorance and accumulates in the life of the ego. But the higher nature, that to which we aspire, acts by unification and transcendence of limitation, is of the nature of knowledge, and culminates in the life divine. The passage from the lower to the higher is the aim of yoga, and this passage may effect itself by the rejection of the lower and escape into the higher, the ordinary viewpoint, or by their transformation of the lower and its elevation to their higher nature. It is this, rather, that must be the aim of an integral yoga. The whole of life is the yoga of nature. The method we have to pursue then is to put our whole conscious being into relation and contact with the divine, and to call him and to transform our entire being into his. In psychological fact, this method translates itself into the progressive surrender of the ego with its whole field and all its apparatus to the beyond ego, with its vast and incalculable but always inevitable workings. There are three outstanding features in this action of the higher when it works integrally on the lower nature. In the first place, it does not act according to a fixed system and succession as in the specialized methods of yoga, but with a sort of free, scattered, and yet gradually intensive and purposeful working determined by the temperament of the individual in whom it operates. The helpful materials which his nature offers and the obstacles which it presents to purification and perfection. In a sense, therefore, each man in his path has his own method of yoga, yet are there certain broad lines of working common to all which enable us to construct not indeed a routine system, but yet some kind of shastra or scientific method of the synthetic yoga. Secondly, the process being integral accepts our nature such as it stands, organized by our past evolution, and without rejecting anything essential, compels all to undergo a divine change. Everything in us is seized by the hands of a mighty artificer and transformed into a clear image of that which is now seeking confusedly to present. In that ever-progressive experience, we begin to perceive how this lower manifestation is constituted, and that everything in it, however seemingly deformed or petty or vile, is the more or less distorted or imperfect figure of some element or action in the harmony of the divine nature. We began to understand what the Vedic rishis meant when they spoke of the human forefathers fashioning the gods as a smith forgoes their crude material in his smithy. Third, the divine power in us uses all life as the means of this integral yoga. Every experience and outer contact with our world environment, however trifling or however disastrous, is used for the work, and every inner experience, even to the most repellent suffering or the most humiliating fall, becomes a step on the path to perfection. And we recognize in ourselves their opened eyes, the methods of God in the world. The purpose of light in the obscure of the mind, in the weak and fallen, of delight in what is grievous and miserable. We see the divine method to be the same in the lower and in the higher working. Only in the one it is pursued tardily and obscurely through the subconscious in nature. In the other, it becomes swift and self-conscious, and the instrument confesses the hand of the master. All life is a yoga of nature seeking to manifest God within itself. Yoga marks the stage at which this effort becomes capable of self-awareness and therefore of right completion in the individual. It is the gathering up and concentration of the movement dispersed and loosely combined in the lower evolution, an integral method and an integral result. Nor would the integrality to which we aspire be real or even possible if it were confined to the individual, since our divine perfection embraces the realization of ourself in being. In life and in love through others as well as through ourselves, the extension of our liberty and of its results in others would be the inevitable outcome, as well as the broadest utility of our liberation and perfection. And the constant and inherent attempt of such an extension would be towards its increasing and ultimately complete generalization in mankind. The divinizing of the normal material life of man and of his greater circular attempt of mental and moral self-culture and the individual and the race by this integralization of a widely perfect spiritual existence would thus be the crown alike of our individual and of our common effort.